Analysts, especially in national security agencies, are generally acknowledged to be among the leading experts in their fields. In a perfect world, they provide informed analysis to policymakers to allow those policymakers to make the best informed decisions. That's the way the system is supposed to work. But what happens when policymakers ignore the analysis? Even worse, what happens when policymakers discount the analysis and then seek out false analysis to support their preconceived policies? I'll tell you what happens. It leads to war. I'm John Kiriakou. You're watching The Whistleblowers. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. It's no secret that the American government during the George W. Bush administration made up its mind to go to war with Iraq on false pretenses. The White House accused Saddam Hussein of building and deploying weapons of mass destruction. That just simply wasn't true. The White House accused Saddam Hussein of being in league with Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. That also wasn't true. George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney wanted to overthrow Saddam. They didn't care what the truth was. We're going to talk about how that cynical decision led to war with the whistleblower who tried to stop it. We're joined by Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kwiatkowski. Karen, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being with us. You were raised in a patriotic, Christian, Republican home, and you freely entered into public service as soon as you became an adult, Karen. You joined the military and you were commissioned as an officer. You eventually rose to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel, and you retired after 21 years of service in the U.S. Air Force and at the National Security Agency. Like all national security whistleblowers, you took your oath to the Constitution seriously. And in the prelude to the Iraq War, you spoke out about the corruption of political influence on the decision to go to war with Iraq. Tell us what that was like. What was it that led you to speak out?
Well, it actually started at the end of the Cold War. I was in the military, of course, and my expectations were, of course, that as the Warsaw Pact had collapsed, and the Soviet Union wasn't a Soviet Union anymore, that NATO would actually shrink and become a much smaller organization. And instead it was the opposite. So that surprised me. I didn't really understand why that was. And then of course they launched into US and NATO wars with the Balkans. So I was a little bit like, that kind of woke me up a little bit. Like I expected one thing and something else happened. And then of course I worked at NSA. And some of the things that NSA was doing were unconstitutional even when I was there. And I didn't, you know, I'm not a techie, but just some of the things that we talked about us doing were a problem, constitutional problem. And yet nobody seemed to care that wasn't an issue. We just, you know, we wouldn't talk about that, but it wasn't really an issue. And then, of course, my last tour, of course, was at the Office of Secretary of Defense in policy. And I was working North Africa. So we were sharing office space with the people doing the Iraq and Iran desks and that kind of thing. So I guess I had become a little more tired of just using the government to play your games. I mean, this is what people seem to be doing. These public servants, these bureaucrats, not so much the guys in uniform. I guess I was allied with them. And many of us would talk about, you know, none of this makes any sense, but, you know, that's what they're doing. So what we were doing didn't have anything to do with national defense. Increasingly, I came to understand that. And then especially what I saw in those final years as the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, I saw actual, because I had access to the intelligence and the information, I could look at something on my desk, classified secret and top secret. And the next day I would see the exact same thing in the New York Times. And I knew I didn't share it. So who was, you know, doing it and who was celebrating it? And, you know, it had nothing to do with defense. It had to do with, we have a military, let's play with it to make our own personal wishes come through. And who are these people? Well, neocons, which had been around for a while. Been around since Reagan, certainly, if not sooner, if not before then. And they were certainly populating the Pentagon when I worked there. And they stayed throughout the Bush administration. They stayed throughout the Obama administration. They stayed in the Trump administration. I mean, John Bolton served as national security advisor, and they're in the Biden administration. So these people who manipulate the defense institutions that are supposed to be constitutionally bound and they're supposed to serve the country and serve the people that pay for them, they don't do any of that. They just use those institutions. And so I guess I was, you know, when you've been in the military, you've been in service for a while, you pretty much lose patience with it. And so I really had over time begun to trust my own gut and my own judgment. And it was not a problem for me to seek out ways to share the information that I had. It didn't bother me at all. I was eager to do it.
You and I both worked with people from the Defense Department's Office of Special Plans, or OSP, in the run-up to the Iraq War. This was an unusual and highly politicized group in the Defense Department that was led by a close former aide to Vice President Dick Cheney by the name of Bill Luddy. I found Luddy to be a dangerous ideologue, and I think you did too. It was Luddy and his cohorts in the Office of Special Plans who pushed the idea of Ahmed Chalabi, an Iraqi dissident and one of the most corrupt people I have ever met in my life, as a possible replacement for Saddam Hussein. When Chalabi fell apart under the weight of his own corruption, the CIA dropped him. But Bill Luddy and OSP continued to support Chalabi and the notion that Chalabi could lead men into battle in Iraq. That, of course, was a pipe dream. Tell us what things were like in OSP at that time. Tell us about how the intelligence community analysis on Iraq was politicized in order to support a war agenda.
They took little bits and pieces of intel, some approved and validated intel, and some just raw information. You know, we would think of it as stuff we read in the newspaper, unconfirmed things, and they promoted a storyline. They created a backstory and promoted a storyline that would help them do what they wanted to do, which of course was to install a puppet to get rid of Saddam Hussein, who really was standing up for notwithstanding that, you know, Rumsfeld was buddies with him only a few years before that, but whatever. Saddam Hussein was a nationalist in many ways. He was standing up for a strong Iraq. Why did he, you know, he's fighting when years ago before with Kuwait because of oil, because he says this is a national resource. And so he's doing things that, and of course decided to go off the petrodollar. That's really dangerous. But so Saddam Hussein is behaving as a independent nationalist person who isn't going to take orders from the United States. That doesn't please the United States, not now, not then, not 40 years before that. So this, you know, Chalabi, they said, well, he'll do what we say. We'll sponsor him. You know, it's funny. I hate to say this, but, you know, is it Chalabi or, you know, Kalinske? Which one am I talking about? I don't even know. But this pattern that the neocons, people like, you know, John Bolton, again, I mention him because he says, well, it's hard to do coups. You know, it's a lot of hard work to conduct these coups because we've done it before. Well, of course, that's what they do. They figure out how they can control another country and specifically another country's resources. And of course, with Iraq, those resources are primarily oil, but also geography. And they wanted it. And they couldn't work with Hussein. They could work with Chalabi. They didn't have any other guy. So they nurture up this image, this storyline. Hey, here's this guy. He's a freedom fighter. He's a Democrat. He's all these people. He's all these, the people love him in Iraq, which of course was. I mean, the stuff was, even the intel that we had was obviously false, but it didn't matter because if you could put it on the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post, you could influence Congress. You could influence think tanks. You could shape a fantasy, and then try to make that happen. And again, you know, I think that's pretty serious to use the military. I think if you're going to kill people, if you're going to have a war, it ought to be for a serious reason. It ought to be for a valid national defense justification. I mean, I'm old fashioned. I think if this country goes to war, the Congress should declare war. You know, that's what the Constitution says. these folks don't believe any of that. In fact, they are not even familiar with the Constitution. That is a dead letter to them. They play a game of self-enrichment, of course, and advocacy of a philosophy of, I hate to say world domination, but certainly at the time, Middle East domination. And Chalabi was part of that, and they sold it. But it's a created story. And of course, you know, when Chalabi died some years ago, I wrote a, not really tongue-in-cheek obituary, but I did write a column for Lou Rockwell. And, you know, I mean, he was a tool that the neocons used, a willing tool, of course. He believed the propaganda, but they, you know, it's the effort that they put into promoting their fantasies and the things that they use and the people that they kill and the money that they spend to promote their fantasies. Again, none of it is constitutional and none of it is moral. None of it is right. And yet it hasn't stopped. It has continued. Chalabi's one example.
You're watching The Whistleblowers. We're speaking with former U.S. Air Force Colonel and Pentagon Intelligence Analyst Karen Kwiatkowski. When we get back from a short break, we'll ask her about the fallout from that fateful decision to go to war with Iraq. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
The discovery of the New World at the end of the 15th century, there appeared Atlantic slave trade. The slave traders from European countries started building forts on the western coast of the African continent to transport the African inhabitants to America to be forced into hard labor. Until the middle of the 17th century, Portugal had played the main role in this atrocious business. Then Great Britain, France, and the Netherlands took the leadership. For the span of 400 years of legal and illegal slave trade, about 17 million people were forcefully shipped across the Atlantic, not including those who died on the way due to unbearable living conditions. Modern historians estimate that for each slave shipped to America, there were five who died while captured, during transportation, and cruel obliteration of rebellion. This ruthless people trade practiced by the leading European countries took away tens of millions of African lives. The Organization of United Nations classifies the transatlantic slave trade as one of the gravest human rights abuses in the history of humanity. This is the biggest act of deportation of people ever seen by mankind.
March the 11th, 2011. The largest earthquake ever recorded in Japan is registered. A 14-meter tsunami devastates the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant.
Sono nel centro di Tokyo, da Kasaka. C'è un terremoto fortissimo, tutti i palazzi stanno muovendosi.
The nuclear reactors are flooded, sparking an horrific disaster. Pio, an Italian journalist living in Japan, decides to go to the area of the nuclear meltdown in Fukushima immediately.
Non è arrivato ancora nessuno delle autorità. Sono passati tre giorni. Ecco, questa è la situazione di questo.
Ecco, siamo arrivati a 2 chilometri dalla centrale di Fukushima, quella che sta facendo preoccupare il Giappone e tutto il resto del mondo.
A 4-year investigation starts. Watch on RT.
Welcome Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking to former U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel and Pentagon Intelligence Analyst Karen Kwiatkowski about the decision to go to war in Iraq based on false and politicized intelligence. Karen, thanks again for being with us. Karen, in 2015, upon Ahmed Chalabi's death, you wrote a piece for LouRockwell.com saying that, in retrospect, the period just before the Iraq War was something of an age of innocence. You wrote, quote, "As painful as it was to watch the U.S. government plunge into the Iraq War based on false WMD warnings, raised in part by Chalabi and his Iraqi National Congress, there was still a sense of hope back then that the truth could be told and the culprits could be held accountable. That seems now to have been a naive dream. In 2003, Chalabi was on track to become the new leader of Iraq just as soon as Paul Wolfowitz's projected cakewalk," that was what he called the war, "was finished. Towards this end, he was using and being used by the neoconservative cabal of Bush-Cheney appointees in the Pentagon, the National Security Council, and the State Department," unquote. And then you said something that strikes me as critically important even today. You said that many of the people who dragged us into war in 2003 continued to advise the Obama administration as late as 2015, and some of those people are still in government today. Is it even possible to save ourselves from warmongers and war criminals when they're practically embedded permanently in the government?
No. As long as they are embedded permanently, which we have seen, and it's not just Victoria Nuland, it's lots of them, they're permanently embedded in the government, and it is impossible to, as long as they are there, to have a different foreign policy. So if you want a different foreign policy, these individuals, not just their philosophy, because, you know, it's a free country, you have free speech, you can think what you want to think, but neoconservatism is not what the American people want. That's not what they believe in. That's not the foreign policy they wish to pursue. And yet we have non-elected bureaucrats, appointees, who persist in this revolving door between government service, think tank, government service, think tank, sometimes a position in Congress back to the government service. Can't be fired, keep getting appointed, keep getting confirmed in some cases. I mean, they are confirming. I mean, this is a different subject, but do you remember when they confirmed Gina Haspel? What is the process? What is the purpose of this process if they can confirm that? Why not? Why have confirmation? Just pick the people you want and put them in there. Why rubber stamp? It's humiliating. But yeah, these folks have to go. And our foreign policy, and particularly our military policy, because when I say foreign policy, I am talking about military policy. It seems like everything is aggressive, militaristic policy. State Department contributes to it. Some of the other agencies contribute to it. The DOD, Intel, CIA, they all contribute to a foreign slash military slash security policy. They take trillions of dollars a year. They cost trillions of dollars a year. And they don't do any good. So I'm ready for radical change. And I think really that they have to go, and the budgets have to be shrunk to the levels that the populists in this country believe we should have, and also what the Constitution envisions, which it didn't envision a standing army. It did envision if we went to war, it would be a people's war. Congress would declare that war. You know, we didn't have that in Vietnam either. It hadn't declared war since World War II. So you take Vietnam, very unpopular war, unpopular, and that unpopularity was memorialized in music and poetry and books and movies and riots and people getting killed by National Guard. You know, it was not a popular war. And it was also, we could have prevented it if they had consulted with the Congress and let the House have a vote and say, do we want to make war in Vietnam? They would have to justify it. They don't like that. So they don't bother with it. And guess what? I don't think it's legal. I don't think it's constitutional. And if you want to save the country as a republic, if you want to have a constitution that matters, and certainly the Bill of Rights and some of these things and the framework of our government, it is something that other countries admire. It's something that we treasure. You know, we've lasted for 240 years. It's kind of a good thing. If you want to keep it, we've got to do something about Washington, because Washington does not abide by that in any way, shape, or form. They don't respect it. And they basically pay lip service to the people's wishes. And, you know, I'd say cut their budget, you know, just and they may end up cutting a budget. If the country goes bankrupt, what are they going to do? Pay them first? It probably will. But I don't think that the expense that the United States has. And, you know, this multipolar world that is already here. But let's say we don't want to admit that it's coming. Okay, it's either it's already here, which it is, or you can say it's coming. But in any case, the United States won't be the global policeman. That may be an opportunity to have a more defensive and peaceful and pro-trade foreign policy, where we can share the good things that make America great, but we're not trying to control everybody else's resources, which again is totally what these wars are about. You know, we're not fighting for democracy. I can't think of any, maybe we have, and you may know, but I can't think of any time we've fought for democracy. We have fought for other people's resources.
Karen, you were inside the Pentagon on 9/11. You later wrote that following the attack and as the U.S. approached war with Iraq, you, quote, witnessed neoconservative agenda bearers within OSP usurp measured and carefully considered assessments, and through suppression and distortion of intelligence analysis, promulgate what were in fact falsehoods to both Congress and the executive office of the president, unquote. Later, you went on to become a source for Knight Ridder, the news agency that broke many of the stories related to the Iraq War. Knight Ridder was always skeptical of the information being released by the Bush administration and the Pentagon. You also appeared in the award-winning documentary film, Why We Fight. How did you make that transition from making your revelations within the chain of command to going public?
Well, I mean, it was an incredible amount of frustration. You know, seeing how information was being misused and manipulated in order to get us into a war. I mean, an actual, you know, not just like, you know, we say, oh, Ukraine's fighting a war and we're giving them billions and billions of dollars. This was a war where Americans were going to go over there and fight, you know, something that should be a serious matter and it should be based on fact. And yet all this was created, you know, stories were told through different chains so that one guy would call the other guy and say, well, can you confirm this? And go, oh, sure, I saw the same thing. It must be true. It was a severe amount of frustration. And again, you know, after you've been in the military for, you know, 15 or 16 years, you kind of have seen things. You kind of, at least I had grown into my own, I trusted my assessment of things where I might not have if I'd been younger. But I'd seen enough that I said, this makes no sense. And plus, of course, it was just me. I had lots of friends who would tell me their end of the story from other offices, what was happening. And most people felt like they couldn't speak out, but I didn't feel that way. I was going to retire. I was planning to retire at my earliest opportunity even before this. So, and I wasn't going to work for these folks afterwards. And I think that makes a difference. And, you know, another thing, and I don't know if we've talked about it, if it's been observed, but it's kind of I was the breadwinner for my family for many, many years, but they say that women, this is, maybe it's a stereotype, maybe it's changed, but I'm born in 1960, so I came up through the 80s, you know, that women don't define their worth as much through their employment, through their jobs, as maybe men do. So for me, I didn't see this as, this is really going to ruin my career. I mean, it would have if I'd stayed in. There was no doubt I couldn't have stayed in. But I didn't see that as a huge issue. It wasn't, to me, it was far more important to really share the information out with somebody that could see if it was worth anything and maybe combat some of the lies. It just, that felt important to me. But also, I wasn't so worried about my reputation as an officer per se, because I believed in the Constitution, and I do think, and this is, you know, we see this, I'm not a big time whistleblower who's really suffered from it like you have, and also Snowden, you know, but all of us had some we put value in the Constitution. We thought it was a serious document. We thought it was a document that our country would work, would live by, it's particularly our leaders. And so, it makes you angry when you see that it's being ignored, that they don't care, that our country is going down a track that is lawless and based on purposeful and fantastical lies and a manipulation of the media and a manipulation of Congress. It's very upsetting. But I think it was upsetting to a lot of people. But again, I didn't see this as, oh, this is going to ruin my career. And then people will be talking about me and they'll say, oh, she had a great career, but then she just threw it all away. That didn't even cross my mind. It had nothing to do with anything. And I wish we had more people who really would care more about their principles and what they know to be right and wrong. Even if I don't agree with them, I don't care. I wish they would trust their own sense of right and wrong more than what their bosses tell them. Because my bosses, Bill Luddy was my direct boss. So, what does that say? Yeah, should I have listened to him and looked up to him in such a way? Oh, he knows better than me? I don't think so. And I hope that generations behind us, younger people than us, have embraced that attitude that they can make their own judgment. They can use their own brain. They can, you don't want to be crazy with it. You if you're ignorant and you think crazy things and you believe them, okay, fine. But really take the risk, because our country has gone down a really, really bad path. And it's not just been recently. I mean, it's been over the past, really this past century. But my whole lifetime, born in 1960, started military life when I was in my early 20s. Really, my whole lifetime, I have witnessed terrible degradation of the Constitution and a terrible future, a terrible presence of our country, bad behavior by the United States of America. It's not right. I can't be proud of it. And I should be able to be proud of my country. We have the right to be proud of our country. And the fact that we can't means there's still work to do.
One can only hope that governments and the policymakers who lead them can learn from the mistakes of the past, but that may be too much to ask. We will probably never find ourselves in a position where people in positions of authority or power do something simply because it's the right thing to do. And sometimes when they make their decisions, especially when those decisions are based on cynical and false information, we find ourselves at war. We can't forget, too, that those wars, no matter how short or how righteous they may seem, maintain a cost in human lives. Always remember that integrity is telling myself the truth. Honesty is telling the truth to others. And no legacy is so rich as honesty. Thank you again to our guest, Karen Kwiatkowski, and thanks to you for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. Until next time.